Good morning. Thanks for joining us here today. My name is Doris Meissner. I'm a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, and I'll be our moderator for this event this morning. I'd like to welcome you to this discussion of the administration's new Deferred Action Program, Strategies for Success. We are live streaming this event, and we would ask you there, first off, to turn off all cell phones so that we don't have those interruptions. Let me begin by introducing the other guests who are here today on the stage with me. First is our featured speaker, Alejandro Mayorkas, who, of course, is the Director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services in the Department of Homeland Security. And then with him are several people who are going to be commenting later in the program, beginning with David Martin, who's the Professor of International Law at the University of Virginia and former Principal Deputy General Counsel at the Department of Homeland Security. Also Muzaffer Shishti, who is the Director of our MPI office at NYU School of Law, and Marielena Hincapié, who is the Executive Director of the National Immigration Law Center, headquartered in Los Angeles. Now, to be precise about our topic this morning, the Deferred Action Program is being called the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. So with that, we have a new acronym, a new immigration acronym, and we will be using that this morning during this program, along with the terminology that's been used before, deferred action. But DACA does make it simpler to talk about, and DACA is, as you know, for people who are under the age of 31, who were brought to this country prior to reaching the age of 16, and are currently in unauthorized status. Now, this population group, of course, has become known as the Dreamers because of proposed legislation called the DREAM Act that has been pending in Congress regarding their status for many years now. As you know, of course, too, the DREAM Act has not passed. However, in June, the administration announced a new initiative that permits granting deferred action to this DREAM population. Deferred action is an exercise of prosecutorial discretion by the Department of Homeland Security. It'll be decided on a case-by-case basis, and it is being implemented by United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security. USCIS was given 60 days to prepare for this program, which is to begin accepting applications on August 15th, 1 week from tomorrow. USCIS is charged with an enormous task here, some of which is in familiar territory, some of which is in uncharted waters for the agency. It announced the guidance that it will use for DACA this past Friday, August 3rd, and we'll have a chance shortly to learn more about that and then to be discussing it more fully. What is new here is the hybrid nature of this deferred action initiative and also its scale. Deferred action is not a legalization program. It does not confer formal legal status, nor can it be converted to permanent residence or to citizenship short of legislation along the lines of something like the DREAM Act. Deferred action is therefore more akin to a temporary protected status or a TPS-like program in that it provides relief from deportation and it provides work authorization to those who can show an economic necessity. But at the same time, it requires more extensive documentation for the decision to be made to grant the deferred action. Regarding the scale, this will be potentially one of the biggest initiatives, if not the biggest initiative, that the agency will have undertaken organizationally for many, many years. Now, MPI has generated estimates of the scale, this population size, for a number of years now, beginning with when the DREAM Act was first proposed. Today, we are releasing our newest estimates of the size of this potential eligible population. You have it in a fact sheet. It's available at the entry and for you to take with you. And what it shows is that the DACA eligible population is 1.76 million people. Now that is up from an estimate of 1.4 million, which we provided in June, because of Friday's criteria announcement. The criteria that were announced on Friday had an element in them which allows people to file applications if they are enrolled in school. And that means that a population of about 350,000 who are in the age range that is eligible for DACA, but that do not currently have high school or GED or other degrees, could enroll and become eligible for DACA during the period of the program. So, to learn more about all of these things, particularly about DACA eligibility and how USCIS will implement and administer this program, I'm very pleased to bring to the podium the Director of the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, Alejandro Mayorkas.
Thank you very much, Doris, and thank you to the Migration Policy Institute for hosting this important engagement this morning. I would like to recognize our colleagues from the White House Domestic Policy Committee, Felicia Escobar and Tyler Moran, and I am joined by a number of colleagues from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and breaking my long-held rule, I will single out one individual, and that is my Chief of Staff, Rebecca Carson, who has put so much incredible thought, heart, and time into the development and implementation of deferred action for childhood arrivals. Over the past 3 years, the administration has undertaken an unprecedented effort to transform the immigration enforcement system into one that focuses on public safety, border security, and the integrity of the immigration system. As the Department of Homeland Security continues to focus its enforcement resources on the removal of individuals who pose a danger to national security or a risk to public safety, including individuals convicted of crimes with particular emphasis on violent criminals, felons, and repeat offenders, DHS will exercise prosecutorial discretion as appropriate to ensure that law enforcement resources are not expended on low-priority cases. As a further step, on June 15, 2012, Janet Napolitano, the Secretary of Homeland Security, announced that certain people who came to the United States as children and meet several key guidelines may request consideration of deferred action for a period of 2 years, subject to renewal, and would then be eligible for work authorization. To implement the Secretary's memorandum, we at USCIS are creating a new process for individuals who meet these guidelines to request consideration of deferred action for childhood arrivals. First, if I can echo something important that Doris articulated, and that is what deferred action is and what it is not. A deferred action is a discretionary determination to defer removal action of an individual as an act of prosecutorial discretion. It does not provide lawful status or a pathway to permanent residence or citizenship. In addition, deferred action does not excuse individuals of any previous or subsequent periods of unlawful presence. Under existing regulations, an individual who receives deferred action and demonstrates economic necessity for employment is eligible to also receive employment authorization for the period of deferred action, in this case, 2 years, and I'll be speaking about that shortly. Individuals who demonstrate that they meet the following guidelines may request consideration of deferred action for childhood arrivals from USCIS. We at USCIS will make our determination on an individualized case-by-case basis. Beginning August 15th, and not before then, requests for deferred action received before August 15th will be rejected. Individuals may request consideration of deferred action for childhood arrivals if they were under the age of 31, as of June 15, 2012, came to the United States before reaching their 16th birthday, have continuously resided in the United States since June 15, 2007, up to the present time, were physically present in the United States on June 15, 2012, and at the time of making the request for consideration of deferred action with USCIS. Entered without inspection before June 15, 2012, or their lawful immigration status expired as of that date. Are currently in school, have graduated or obtained a certificate of completion from high school, have obtained a General Education Development or GED certificate, or are an honorably discharged veteran of the Coast Guard or Armed Forces of the United States, and have not been convicted of a felony, significant misdemeanor, three or more other misdemeanors, and do not otherwise pose a threat to national security or public safety. Allow me, if I can, to clarify a few of the guidelines that I just outlined. If an individual has never been in removal proceedings, or the proceedings have been terminated prior to the request, the individual must be at least 15 years of age or older at the time of filing their request for deferred action. If the individual is in removal proceedings, has a final removal order, or has a voluntary departure order, and the individual is not in immigration detention, the individual can request consideration of deferred action for childhood arrivals, even if he or she is under the age of 15 at the time of filing his or her request. In all instances, individuals cannot be the age of 31 or older as of June 15, 2012, to be considered for deferred action for childhood arrivals. With respect to travel, a brief, casual, and innocent absence from the United States will not interrupt continuous residence guideline as long as it was before August 15, 2012. After August 15, 2012, if one travels outside of the United States, the individual will not be considered for deferred action under this process. If an individual, though, receives deferred action in their case and they do want to travel outside of the United States, they must apply for advance parole by filing the Form I-131 application for travel document and paying the applicable fee of $360. USCIS will determine whether the purpose for international travel is justifiable based on the circumstances described in the request. Generally, USCIS will only grant advance parole if the individual is traveling for humanitarian purposes, educational purposes, or employment purposes. They may not apply for advance parole unless and until USCIS determines whether to defer action in their case pursuant to the consideration of deferred action for childhood arrivals process. An individual cannot apply for advance parole at the same time as they submit a request for consideration of deferred action for childhood arrivals. With respect to the school requirement, to be considered currently in school under the guidelines, individuals must be enrolled in school on the date they submit their request for consideration of deferred action under this process, and we anticipate providing additional guidance on this subject on August 15th. Allow me, if I can, to turn to the documentation that we will evaluate in deciding whether or not the exercise of discretion is appropriate in a particular case. Documentation to demonstrate that an individual came to the United States before the age of 16 has resided in the United States for at least 5 years immediately preceding June 15, 2012, and was physically present on June 15, 2012 includes, but is not limited to, these are examples: financial records, medical records, school records, employment records, and military records. Documentation to demonstrate that an individual is currently in school, has graduated from high school, or has obtained a GED certificate includes, but is not limited to, diplomas, GED certificates, report cards, and school transcripts. documentation to demonstrate that an individual is an honorably discharged veteran of the Coast Guard or Armed Forces of the United States includes, but is not limited to, the report of separation forms, military personnel records, and military health records. A comment, if I can, on affidavits. And please understand that in deciding the documentation that we would accept and evaluate a request for deferred action and whether or not to include affidavits in that documentation, we considered both the documentary hurdles that individuals might confront while at the same time ensuring that we protect the integrity of the immigration system and combat fraud. Affidavits generally will not be sufficient on their own to demonstrate that an individual meets the guidelines for USCIS to consider them for deferred action for childhood arrivals. However, affidavits may be used to support meeting the following guidelines only if the documentary evidence is available is insufficient or lacking. A gap in the documentation demonstrating that an individual meets the 5-year continuous residence requirements, and a shortcoming in documentation with respect to the brief, casual, and innocent departures during the 5 years of required continuous residence. We recognize that there may be gaps in the available documentation for individuals requesting deferred action here. Circumstantial evidence may be used to establish the following guidelines and factual showings if available documentary evidence is insufficient or lacking and shows that they were physically present in the United States on June 15, 2012, they came to the United States before reaching their 16th birthday, they satisfy the 5-year continuous residence requirement as long as they present direct evidence of continued residence in the United States for a portion of the required 5-year period, and the circumstantial evidence is used only to fill in gaps in the length of continuous residence proven by the direct evidence, and any travel outside the United States during the 5 years of required continuous presence was brief, casual, and innocent. We took into consideration the documentary realities that undoubtedly the young people requesting deferred action will confront. Additional information about what documentation can be submitted will also be provided by us on August 15th. Information provided in an individual's request is protected from disclosure to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, commonly known as ICE, and U.S. Customs and Border Protection, commonly known as CBP, for the purpose of immigration enforcement proceedings, unless the requester meets the criteria for the issuance of a notice to appear or a referral to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement under the criteria set forth in our USCIS's Notice to Appear guidance. That guidance is published, has been in effect for a number of months now, and it is accessible at our website at www.uscis.gov/NTA. While protecting public safety and ensuring national security, we are mindful of the fact that individuals who very well may receive a grant of deferred action under this effort, but might be hesitant to come forward because of fear revealing their current undocumented status to the United States government. And it is balancing those interests and trying to ensure that people who are indeed eligible for deferred action come forward, who could qualify under our discretionary guidelines, ensuring that they do come forward, we set forth the confidentiality provision that I describe now. Individuals whose cases are deferred pursuant to the consideration of deferred action for childhood arrivals process will not be referred to ICE. The information may be shared with national security and law enforcement agencies, including ICE and CBP,
for purposes other than removal, including for assistance in the consideration of deferred action for childhood arrivals, to identify or prevent fraudulent claims, for national security purposes or for the investigation or prosecution of a criminal offense. This information sharing policy covers family members and guardians in addition to the requester. This policy, it may be modified, superseded, or rescinded at any time without notice, and it does not, and is not intended to, confer a right and may not be relied upon to create any right or benefit. Allow me, if I can, to take a minute to describe the filing process that we will be implementing on August 15th. Beginning on that date, individuals will be able to submit a request for consideration of deferred action to USCIS through a new form, together with a second form requesting an employment authorization document. What we did was we tried to create a process that is efficient, that enables us to deliver results as swiftly as possible, and that provides a positive customer experience, a positive experience that the public expects of us and that we expect of ourselves. To do so, we leveraged existing systems and processes. Individuals meeting the guidelines who are not in detention will affirmatively request consideration of deferred action for childhood arrivals from USCIS through this process. This includes individuals in removal proceedings with a final order of removal or with a voluntary departure or order. Please note that now individuals in removal proceedings will be making their request of USCIS and not ICE. The only individuals who will seek a review of their case from ICE will be those currently in detention. We made that change believing that USCIS, as a centralized agency to receive all of the requests for deferred action and to evaluate them according to the guidelines that I outlined, would be most efficient and achieve the greatest consistency, which is a very important hallmark of a good program. Requests of USCIS will be mailed to the USCIS lockbox and will be reviewed at all four USCIS service centers. And this allows us, Doris mentioned the significant volume of work that this effort will involve. This allows us to move the work around internally within the agency as workflows require, as efficiency dictates, while providing, as I mentioned, a positive and seamless customer experience. The total fees will be $465. We are still developing the forms and will be submitting them to the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, for review. Pending OMB clearance, the forms and instructions will be available on the USCIS website on August 15, 2012. And as I mentioned before, any requests received before then will be rejected. There are no fee waivers available for the deferred action for childhood arrivals process. We recognize that individuals requesting deferred action may actually have a financial need, of course, and for them, the total fee of $465 may prove difficult, but at the same time, USCIS is an agency that is funded by the fees it receives, and in order to really sustain our ability to execute this program efficiently and swiftly, as everyone envisions and expects, we were not able to implement a fee waiver program. There will, however, be fee exemptions available if individuals can demonstrate they are, one, under 18 years of age, homeless, in foster care, or otherwise lacking any parental or other familial support, and their income is less than 150% of the U.S. poverty level. Or two, they cannot care for themselves because they suffer from a serious chronic disability and their income is less than 150% of the U.S. poverty level. Or three, have at the time of the request accumulated $25,000 or more in debt in the past 12 months as a result of unreimbursed medical expenses for themselves or an immediate family member, and their income is less than 150% of the U.S. poverty level. Even though we depend upon fees to be able to afford the implementation of this effort, we recognize, as I mentioned, the financial need of some in the community, and we wanted to be sure to address the needs of the most vulnerable. And the guidelines that I just outlined, we believe, achieve that outreach to the most acutely vulnerable. The fee exemption request must be submitted and decided before an individual submits their request for consideration of deferred action for childhood arrivals without a fee. There will be a separate process when an individual requests an exemption from the total fees that I have identified. That process will precede in time the process of requesting deferred action for childhood arrivals. After a deferred action request is received by USCIS, individuals will then be scheduled for a biometric services appointment and will be subject to background checks against a variety of databases maintained by DHS and other federal government agencies. We will then make our determination of whether to exercise prosecutorial discretion in the individual case. And individuals will be able to track the progress of their deferred action request online. If we at USCIS deny the request for consideration of deferred action for childhood arrivals, individuals cannot file a motion to reopen or reconsider and cannot appeal the decision. This is an exercise of prosecutorial discretion. We will not review our discretionary determinations. We have set up protocols to ensure the quality and consistency of our decisions. Let me, if I can, speak of the preserving the integrity or protecting the integrity of the immigration system and ensuring the public safety and national security. We will implement the deferred action for childhood arrivals process in a manner that ensures that those critical and priority goals are achieved. Individuals who have been convicted of a felony offense, a significant misdemeanor offense, or three or more other misdemeanor offenses will not be considered for deferred action under the new process. A felony is a federal, state, or local criminal offense punishable by imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year. For purposes of this process, a significant misdemeanor is a misdemeanor as defined by federal law, specifically one for which the maximum term of imprisonment authorized is 1 year or less, but greater than 5 days, and that meets the following criteria. One, regardless of the sentence imposed, is an offense of domestic violence, sexual abuse or exploitation, burglary, unlawful possession or use of a firearm, drug distribution or trafficking, or driving under the influence. Or two, if not an offense noted above, is one for which the individual was sentenced to time in custody of more than 90 days. For purposes of this process, a non-significant misdemeanor is any misdemeanor as defined by federal law, specifically, and I want to be very clear here, one for which the maximum term of imprisonment authorized is 1 year or less, but greater than 5 days, and that meets the following criteria. One, is not an offense of domestic violence, sexual abuse or exploitation, burglary, unlawful possession or use of a firearm, drug distribution or trafficking, or driving under the influence, and is one for which the individual was sentenced to time in custody of 90 days or less. it is important to emphasize that driving under the influence is a significant misdemeanor regardless of the sentence imposed. A minor traffic offense, on the other hand, will not be considered a misdemeanor. As a matter of discretion, a requester's entire offense history will be considered along with other facts to determine whether, under the totality of the circumstances, they warrant an exercise of prosecutorial discretion. If the case does not involve a criminal offense, fraud, or a threat to national security or public safety, it will not be referred to ICE for purposes of removal proceedings, except where DHS determines there are exceptional circumstances. If an individual knowingly makes a misrepresentation or knowingly fails to disclose facts, they will be treated as an immigration enforcement priority to the fullest extent permitted by law and be subject to criminal prosecution and or removal from the United States. We are very concerned about the risk of immigration scams and unscrupulous practitioners who seek to take advantage of the population of young people who may request deferred action through this process. We have already implemented, now over a year ago, an initiative to combat the unauthorized practice of immigration law, commonly referred to as notario fraud, working with our partners across the federal government, the Federal Trade Commission, the United States Department of Justice, state and local law enforcement agencies, community-based organizations, civic organizations. We launched a nationwide effort to combat the unauthorized practice of immigration law under a maxim, the wrong help can hurt. And we are, of course, especially concerned about the vulnerability of young individuals who could be requesting deferred action under the process that I have outlined. It is very important that people understand that the time to request deferred action under this process has not commenced, that it will not commence before August 15th. We have information and resources to educate the public on how to avoid immigration services scams, and that information is available on our website at www.uscis.gov/avoidscams. We are currently engaging in our field offices and our district offices throughout the country with the public, educating them on how to detect the unauthorized practice of immigration law, how to detect and report notario fraud, and what resources are available to protect oneself and to protect others. We are very mindful of the need to communicate how the process will work, the guidelines that are available to educate people who will seek to request deferred action for childhood arrivals under the process that I have described. And we are going to be, and already are, very forward-leaning in the dissemination of information, understanding that not everyone will necessarily listen here to the live stream or in person at the Migration Policy Institute. We are very grateful for media coverage of this event because it is a very effective way to disseminate information to a thirsty and needy public. We have designed a web page and launched that web page with information about the process. We will be amplifying our messages through posts on Facebook and Twitter, and we will really be very active in the coming days and weeks to ensure that the public who seeks to avail themselves of the process that I have described is an educated public, an informed public, and therefore a protected one. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to give Allie a chance to get seated here, and then we're going to have a dialogue. I'm going to talk a little bit further with Allie about some of the points that he made, and then draw in the other people that are seated on the stage and see if we can flesh out some of the layers and layers of nuance that will accompany this. But I do have to start by saying that, you know, of course there's been, as you say, an enormous appetite for information and a desire for the government to talk about what's going to be required for this program. As I said at the beginning, this has been an incredibly short preparation time, so congratulations for being able to get guidance out and for having that guidance be really very complete to start with in terms of laying the laying out the contours of the program. I can only imagine what it really is like, though, to be sitting in your shoes at this point. And I'm wondering what you are doing about the staffing and the training that will be required in order to handle this caseload. Can you talk a little bit about how that process is going to unfold and what your expectations are?
Sure, Doris. And I should say the shoes in which I rest are very comfortable shoes because of the, quite frankly, the people that are around me around the conference room table on a daily basis as we plan and prepare and discuss issues. I cannot overstate the level of expertise and knowledge and incredible judgment that my colleagues at USCIS have. We took a look at and studied the available data, publicly available, published by MPI and other resources. With respect to the anticipated volume of individuals who would be availing themselves of the process that we define, and we began to plan according to our experience the levels of staffing that we will need to implement this program in a way that achieves the overarching goals that I identified, a very good customer experience, an easy and swift process, a clear and well-defined process, one that is efficient and affordable for the agency, that is economically sound, and one that ensures public safety, national security, and protects the integrity of the immigration system. We have begun to plan and execute on enhancing our staffing models and other resources to be able to deliver this program, to be able to implement and execute this program. And we are developing training materials and sections of the adjudicator's field manual so that our people in the field understand with precision the guidelines that I outlined, some of the more nuanced points that we will be clarifying with the further guidance on August 15th. And that the adjudicators are well trained to deliver sound and consistent decisions.
Are you going to be you're going to be doing actual hiring. You're going to be able to add staff?
Yes, we will.
And are they going to be dedicated to this program and this to this adjudication so that there's a, you know, dedicated workforce for this purpose, or is will they be doing other kinds of adjudications?
We're still working out those specifics, but what we thought we would do is use the service center personnel as the best point for the decision making for a number of reasons. Number one, as I mentioned, I think in my remarks, the use of the service centers allows us to leverage existing resources and systems, including, quite frankly, IT. Systems and the ability to move the work around as volumes warrant. We will have concentration of individuals reviewing the request for deferred action for childhood arrivals. We do expect a focus of adjudication resources to achieve consistency. So we do anticipate developing expertise within the service centers for this.
I think that's an important point because that is one of the things that comes out of the learnings of the legalization program, even though this is not a legalization program, but this kind of a huge ramp up in caseload on a specific topic tends to work well if people are trained to do that and are focused on that. And of course, as you know, you'll always face the criticism that if you concentrate on this caseload, then you're harming the time processing expectations that your other caseload handles. So I take it you're going to be working hard to keep that calibrated.
We are, and we're working very hard to do that, to achieve that. I should say, just to give you an idea of not only the amount of work, but the precision and thinking that is underway by our leaders and our experts in the agency when we speak of training. It's not just developing a training material and executing it, but rather developing the training material with the expertise around the table. Then really using it for a separate process of training the trainers, identifying individuals who are best suited to train the workforce that will be dedicated to reviewing the request for deferred action, training them, training the trainers, and then having the trainers train the decision makers, as well as the supervisors who will be reviewing cases.
Are you at a point where you are even able to hazard a guess on what you hope is your ideal processing time from point of submission to point of a person hearing the answer, assuming that it's a straightforward case?
So processing times and their average processing times, Doris, are a function of at least two important factors. One is the volume of requests, in this case, requests for deferred action for childhood arrivals. And two, and this is something that very often people overlook, the pace at which that volume is realized. In other words, will the agency experience a steady flow of volume from August 15th forward? Will people who wish to request deferred action, will they file very quickly? Will some wait to see how others do? Will it be a mix? And it's not just aggregate volume, but it's the pace at which that volume is received by the agency that impacts processing times. Our goal is to deliver results accurately and quickly, and see how the volume flow is paced at the outset of the program to better calibrate an overarching average processing time objective.
Okay, so we're not there yet. We need to see what the submissions are.
I think we
are.
Need to see what they are.
Right. David, let me ask you what the about the underlying premise of this program. The underlying premise, obviously, is prosecutorial discretion, and yet there certainly is a lively argument about that discretion and whether it exists and whether this is legitimate. Talk to us about prosecutorial discretion and how it applies here.
Well, prosecutorial discretion is a function of any law enforcement agency, unless in some mythical world they were funded at a capacity that could handle absolutely every hint of a violation. Prosecutorial discretion can be exercised systematically or just kind of by default because you do some things until you run out of resources. It's been, as you know, a major effort because one of your memos launched a lot of this systematic thinking, a major effort over the last 10 or 12 years to try to be more systematic within immigration enforcement about the choices that are made. This is a particularly systematic way of doing it, and it fits well with some of the earlier efforts that were undertaken. Most people here are probably aware of the so-called Morton memos that have outlined prosecutorial discretion. There's been a review process there. This is one that's very much in keeping with that, but more systematic in addressing a particular set of issues here. Now, the controversy comes up because some people have claimed that Chris Kobach is one of the main figures who has done this, who claimed that, well, Congress took away all prosecutorial discretion in these sorts of settings, or at least in most, with regard to most of the kinds of cases that would be encountered here, that is, people who entered without inspection. It's premised on a couple of provisions. One that's been around in the laws for a very long time that says with any applicant for admission, unless the inspecting officer considers them clearly and beyond a doubt entitled to land, they shall be detained for removal proceedings. And it's as though, well, then any applicant for admission who doesn't pass that test is held for admission. First of all, that hasn't been the practice under this provision for a long time. People have been paroled for decades without being placed into removal proceedings. So it doesn't fit in the application of that particular provision. But the other part is a provision that was added in 1996. It says anybody in the country who hasn't been admitted shall be considered an applicant for admission. And so Chris Kobach and some others put that together with the other provision, say, well, you have to put them into proceedings and consider them that way. I just want to digress for a moment and mention that provision was not put in there. I know because I was involved in some of that legislative back and forth in the 1990s, mid-1990s, about 1995, that's where the five comes from, in about 1995, where there was discussion about that. There had been a BIA decision that had made it somewhat unclear whether parolees whose parole was ending could be considered applicants for admission unless they chose to apply. A case called Badalamenti involved someone who had been extradited here and then was acquitted. And the BIA suggested, well, you have to give them some time to leave on their own. There was a real concern since in 1996 we took entrance without inspection, and instead of counting them as deportable aliens, we counted them as people who hadn't been admitted. There was a real worry that they might say, oh, well, give me a few weeks and I'll leave. I really don't want to be counted as an applicant for admission. So it was a technical provision to overcome a BIA decision and entirely intended to give INS more discretion in being able to file charges against individuals, not to take away their discretion. But the more profound point is that in any situation of law enforcement, discretion exists. And the word shall cannot be treated as an absolute mandate to visit this treatment on everyone. Almost every criminal law is written in such a way that if you steal something worth between $100 and $500, you shall be fined $1,000 and imprisoned for not more than 6 months. But nobody believes that that cabins the discretion of enforcement officers. So this is very much in keeping with that tradition. The legal argument that Chris Kobach and others have presented is superficially plausible, but it really misreads the legislative history and the history of the way this has been practiced. It's perfectly appropriate. In fact, it's so much better to have a systematic way of exercising discretion rather than a sort of random model that you just, anybody you stumble across, you have to put into proceedings unless you're convinced that they're entitled. So this is quite legitimate. It's the way that we really should have been doing enforcement for a long time. It's part of a long process to being systematic about that. But that does mean, of course, that enforcement continues. This is not a way to say we're not doing enforcement. It's a way to say we're reorienting enforcement in systematic and sensible ways rather than just having it a more random process.
You know, you're mentioning the 1950s makes us all laugh because there are a number of us that have been involved in all of this for a very long time. And one of those people is Moose Shishti, who I'm going to ask the next question to, because I want him to draw on long experience going back to the 1980s in working with the legalization program and other programs that require people to come forward when they are at risk. And that is certainly the case here. So could you talk a bit in reaction to what you've heard here and in reaction to the program as it's been announced, about the ingredients for success that are critical here in terms of building confidence in the program in this population.
Thank you, Doris. First of all, I definitely wasn't there in the 50s. I got all my experience on this and cut my teeth in the 1986 law. And there are clearly temptations to draw comparisons between these two events in our lives. But let me tell you, there are three basic areas in which there's a total distinction between these two programs. A, this is not a statutory program. Two, there's no timeline. And three, there are no qualified designated entities which are enshrined in the statute to provide a buffer between the applicant population and the government. So those are three very different ingredients that made the 86 program different. Having said that, there are still very important lessons from the 86 program which would inform us about what would make a successful program. And in my view, they come both on one hand from the government and on the other hand from the private sector and the applicants or who choose to advise the applicants. First, on the government, I have to tell you that the most important thing you have to do is to issue timely decisions. People have to build confidence very early on. The very initial response and reaction to this program is going to be critical. People have to gain confidence that the government meant what they said, both in terms of the applications are getting approved if they meet the guidelines that you have, I think, so well laid out now, and they do it in a timely manner. Second is that the confidentiality elements of this policy are protected. I think if people see that they or their parents are being placed in jeopardy in proceedings as a result of this, that's going to put a huge damper, especially in the initial stages of the program. On the confidentiality thing, one item that I might quickly raise with you, which hasn't been raised so far, is the employers. I think a lot of documentation, given the nature of this population, is going to come from employers. They're the only ones who probably are going to have some consistent record of these people being in there. And you have to, if whether formally or informally, you have to give some understanding that employers won't be targeted for violation of the employer sanctions law as a result of having or having employed someone who is an applicant for deferred action. I think that was a big issue in 1986, and there was strong, confidence measures given to the employers. The second, I would say that, especially since there's no judicial review here, and there's not even an administrative appeal, the consistency of the determinations is going to be critical. That people have to know if the same applications get submitted in New York as they're in California, they're going to get treated the same way. You've obviously decided that you're going to do this in four different centers. I mean, one of the reasons I think the legalization program 86 worked very well is that there was just one place which made the determination of applicants in the final stage of review. So that there is consistency and accountability. And if I had my druthers, I would appoint one DACA czar, for lack of any other term, who would report directly to you, and whose job would be to the principal point of authority, both in terms of determination and accountability. That if important final decisions have to be made, whether discretion should be exercised or not, the final decision would be made by one person who would be answerable to you. In the absence of just one center where you could send all the applications, if four centers are going to be used, you have to make a lot of confidence building that the four determinations are made, I think, consistently. I know that you have done I noticed in the guidelines that there will be a scope for requests for evidence. I think that's extremely important in the absence of administrative appeal or judicial review. But I would say that the consistency of those RFPs is going to be very important, both in terms of the confidence within the agency itself about what is a good documentation and what's not, and I think, frankly, confidence among the advocates of the applicants, because they would know what the government likes and what it doesn't like in terms of documentation to prepare better applications in the future. The last thing I would say on this is that please don't issue denials in a way denials for about 6 months in a center and then issue them all in once. I think that's going to create a lot of havoc, both in terms of the confidence building and in terms of the advocates being able to respond to this. From the private sector, I think it's frankly the mirror image of this, is that the private sector has to build confidence in the very initial stages that this thing is working. And they have a very difficult razor's edge task, much more difficult than we had in 1986. Because on one hand, you want to encourage people to come forward, obviously. But on the other hand, there are serious risks in this program. And people have to weigh them. And it'll be very difficult for advocates to make the decision. The decisions ultimately will have to be made by individual applicants. But I think they have to be extremely well informed about the pluses and minuses of coming forward in this program, which also means that we'll have to have a very robust legal service component in the private sector about advising these people about the pluses and minuses of this program. And the outreach, as we got to know very well in 1986, no, this is not a one-size-fit-all outreach kind of an event. is that given the disparity of these populations, there'll be people in the rural sectors, there'll be people, you know, in metropolitan centers. The same media outreach does not always work. In fact, I would probably like to believe that in this case, the outreach through schools is going to be much more important. The outreach through churches is going to be much more important than any sort of big, broader media outreach. And I think the last thing I want to say on the private sector, given that they'll be walking this razor's edge, they have to make a decision. There's nothing like a perfect application. None of us have ever prepared a perfect application. That they have to build the confidence that it has to be an acceptable application. It has to be acceptable given the guidelines that you have issued. And we have to have some faith in the word of the government, that if Alejandro Mayorkas says these are going to be guidelines, that they will be complied by his officers. And they will be adhered to by the next administration if there's a different administration that comes after it. Because we are a country of laws where I think decisions of prior administrations should be taken seriously. But I think for the private sector to give confidence to the applicants will obviously be determined a lot by how the government responds in the initial stages of the processing.
You know, this. Go ahead.
No. If I may, but some very, very important points. We gave thought the issue of consistency and timeliness that you raise are issues of tremendous significance, and we've given a great deal of thought to them. When deciding whether or not the work could be centralized, one of the factors that we considered was, of course, something to which Doris alluded earlier, which is our existing workload and managing that workload effectively for the individuals who comprise it now and will continue to do so. And so given the estimates with respect to the volume of people that may be requesting deferred action under this effort, we could not functionally really centralize all the work in one location. We had to be more nimble than that and draw upon the workforce in different parts. But we thought that the service center model provided the greatest level of centralization and therefore consistency. In addition, we have developed a supervisorial review architecture to review the analyses that are made, pardon me, by the frontline adjudicators to ensure that there is consistency. We are very mindful of the timeliness quotient that you articulate. These are not, however, decisions that will be made within a few days of our receipt of a request for deferred action. We have a process in place that includes, as I mentioned, the need to conduct a background check of the individuals to ensure that our public safety, national security priorities are appropriately addressed. And so what we have done to ensure timeliness, the confidence that it instills, and at the same time, a very fulsome process in terms of our important agency mission objectives, is to issue a receipt very quickly so that an individual who's requested deferred action, whose application has been accepted for review, will receive a receipt and see that the process has begun, and then subsequently receive a notice of an appointment at an application support center, and those are located throughout the country, so that the individual next sees that they have been scheduled for an appointment to capture the biometrics. And so that we are trying to notify individuals in the different stages of the process as quickly as possible so that they have confidence, number one, in the clarity and transparency of our efforts, and two, that progress is being made in the review of the case.
Good. Let me draw Maria Elena in on related points here, which is to think of this now from the standpoint of the applicant and what it is that the applicant needs to do to present an application that has that meets the requirements. From an applicant standpoint, what do you think are going to be some of the difficulties that applicants face in taking advantage of this program?
Great. Thank you, Doris, and thank you to Director Mayorkas for attending this important and very timely event. And for all of the staff that have been doing such an incredible job. It's really tremendous that in such a short time frame, so much, you've been able to accomplish so much. And we on the NGO side are definitely feeling the challenge of preparing for this in such a short time frame. But I also want to acknowledge the role that the Dreamers have played in securing this important policy change. They are not only an inspiration to many of us in the immigrant rights field, but really have started to transform the field. And I actually argue that they will transform the United States now that they are being given this temporary reprieve from deportation and access to education and to the workforce will definitely benefit our country greatly. So again, thank you to MPI for hosting this. As the Dreamers, my younger colleagues, I definitely was not one of those around in the 1950s, nor can I take any credit at all for the 1986, but I've learned a tremendous amount from all of you at this stage, and I would not dare to speak for Dreamers, so I consulted them yesterday to get a sense from them about what the greatest concerns are from the applicant perspective. And as Moose has just shared, they're very similar. So one is the confidentiality concerns. Unfortunately, because of the timing of this policy change, given the presidential elections, there are some very serious concerns that even the guidelines that were issued last Friday don't give enough security to Dreamers that are concerned about themselves or their family members. And so again, to the extent that the administration can continue to clarify the steps that will be taking, as well as public events like this to assure applicants that information will be kept confidential, will be really critical. And the employer issue has definitely been raised by the Dreamers in terms of being concerned about what happens when they do get work authorization. Can they come forward? Will that result in being fired by employers? So any guidance that can be provided to employers as well will be very critical. One of the second concern raised by the Dreamers is the different evidentiary requirements. So again, more information as to what kind of documentation will suffice. Particularly, they've expressed concerns about the physical the requirement that they be physically present on June 15th, and what will qualify as circumstantial evidence. And related to that, on the educational requirements as well. The third concern that they've raised has to do with the complexity of the criminal provisions that may bar them from applying. And because this is a young population, many of whom may have, as many of you may have engaged in probably not the best behavior during high school, for example, some of them are concerned that the way that currently the criminal provisions have been, the guidelines with respect to criminal provisions may still be of concern to them. I think some of the issues that they've raised is, for example, the totality of traffic offenses. So it was great to hear that driving without a driver's license, that kind of a traffic offense would not disqualify you, but that CIS will still look at all of your driving history and any traffic offenses. Gang membership has been raised as a concern as well. And the reason for that is in many poor communities of color, young people may find themselves on a list as a gang member just based on the zip code that they live in without even knowing that they're on this list, that law enforcement has placed them on that. So some type of distinction between conviction for gang-related activity versus simply being listed as a gang member. And then among the different criminal provisions, there's also a concern about the definition of felony, because some states, only a few, actually define misdemeanor, provide sentences for misdemeanors that are more than 1 year or longer. And again, because that's the way that the felony is being defined, they're concerned that misdemeanor will rise to be considered a felony under this program. And then the last concern from the applicant perspective, and this is particularly from our organization at the National Immigration Law Center, is for low-income immigrants, the fee. And again, really important that the fee is $465. For some low-income immigrants, that will still be a challenge. And so I think this is where the public sector will need to play a very important role. We understand and really support the goal of having this program be self-sustaining, but the public sector, both philanthropy as well as private donors, corporations, really are needed to step up at this point to help defray some of these costs for low-income immigrants.
Maria Elena, do you see any of that stepping up taking place? I mean, you're from California. California, if you look at the fact sheet, has a quarter of the population likely to be eligible for this program. What's happening on the ground in terms of helping people? to submit applications that are good applications?
Yeah, so there are efforts completely underway. I would say on the legal representation side, because as Moose has mentioned, is really one of our biggest challenges. We at the National Immigration Law Center, in coordination with our legal services partners, so the American Immigration Lawyers Association, the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild Clinic, and other nonprofit legal service providers, have joined efforts. We've created the National Legal Implementation Strategy Team to really map out a national implementation for legal services, and are starting to work with the affiliates and chapters at the local level across the country. In California, because we have the largest number of Dreamers, we're talking about close to or over 400,000 individuals who may qualify, the community has already started to organize. So it's both the nonprofit legal services community as well as the funder community to really start figuring out how to support this from a funding perspective and what's going to be needed. But I have to say, it's a challenge. I'm sure the way that the government is facing this in terms of implementing this from the NGO side, it is it's going to require a lot of resources.
That's right. And on this employer point, which is an interesting point that has been raised, according to our data, 58% of these people are employed. So the employer dimension of this could be a significant dimension in terms of the points that have been raised. Well, I want to open up the floor to questions, but before I do that, so get ready. Before I do that, I want one quick point, David, for you to respond to again, that goes to the structure of this program. Talk to us very quickly about the significance of this program being described through guidance, field guidance, as compared with rulemaking, a regulation.
Well, that's been an ongoing issue with a number of initiatives that have been taken by the Obama administration. I, at various times, talked to many people in this room when I was at DHS. They were urging regulations. We were generally resistant. There are a couple of reasons for that. One, regulation process has become incredibly cumbersome now. It involves elaborate economic analysis. This could never have been set up in less than a year, I think, if one had gone the regulation way. Secondly, prosecutorial discretion is jealously guarded by the Justice Department and by all law enforcement agencies as something that is exactly that, discretion. And if it becomes too formalized, and particularly if it becomes subject to judicial review, which to some extent is the reason why some people want to have it in regulations rather than guidance, the incentives not to go down that route are enormous. And so I understand the reason for that, why people want those kinds of checks and balances, but I think we need to develop a more extensive appreciation for the kinds of checks and balances that can come through the kinds of supervisory review, management systems for checking on consistency and quality of decisions. And because, I have to say, it's not as though judicial review is consistent either. You get very different results from different federal judges. So I think there are better opportunities for consistency and quality through that process. I think it's important to remain that way. And if there's sort of a requirement for everything to be so formalized and reviewable, the internal pressures are great to say, no, we're not going to write it down. We'll pretend it's just random. There's nothing to be reviewed. We need systems where these can be more formalized, and I think that's only going to happen by way of guidance. It needs to be that way. And I think probably the same thing is true with regard to formal appeals processes, although I would hope there would be some room, a little bit more in practice than maybe what is described so far in the written guidance. If somebody really believes that there was a very great mistake made, that they could raise it in some fashion with the officer who considered it.
Okay, time for questions. Now, I will use the mic in the first two rows if there are any press questions, and then for the audience, there are microphones partway up.
Director Mayorkas, good to see you. Fernando Pizarro, Univision. We would like you to comment on the estimate released this morning by MPI. Is this 1.7 million figure, as opposed to the 1.3.9, I believe, from before, is this something realistic, given the changes or the regulations announced on Friday?
With respect to the guidelines announced on Friday, Fernando, what we've done is we've modeled our operational readiness based on the data that was publicly available at the outset, understanding that data is only an estimate or comprise only estimates of a population that is undocumented, and therefore those are inherently rough estimates. And we developed or have planned for operational nimbleness should the volumes vary to some degree, either or less than what was estimated or more. So we are prepared and will be prepared to implement this to capture the increased estimate that MPI published this morning.
David Grant, Christian Science Monitor. Just two quick questions. First is, you talked a lot about building confidence with employers, but I don't remember if I heard anything specific about what you would do to do that, so maybe you guys could put forward just a few sort of thoughts about how that would be done. The second question I have is there any risk for people coming out, going into this program, and there'd be a change of political regime here in a few months, and then that program ceased to exist come January 1st? Did you sort of address that possibility, whether that's a concern for folks that you talk to in the Dreamer community, and how you might deal with that from an administrative perspective?
Moose, you raised the employer point. Why don't you respond to the question of what...
You know, I think it has to be done either explicitly or implicitly, that employers should be given some assurance that just because they gave documentation regarding the date of employment of a particular person who becomes an applicant, that that itself will not target them for employer sanctions. Of course, you can never give immunity to an employer for having violated the employer sanctions law. But in the same way as you're giving that this, the act of application will not render you in removal proceedings, absent some other criteria, I mean, some similar assurance to the employers that just by giving some verification of employment will by itself not trigger an audit or prosecution with employer sanctions law. I think that would help.
Mm-hmm. And if I may, Doris, I think there are a couple of things on that that would be helpful as well. So one is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Business Liaison Office could provide some guidance on that. They issue really great fact sheets and other information for employers. The Department of Justice, Office of Civil Special Counsel within the Civil Rights Division also can issue an opinion letter or guidance. They do a lot of outreach to employers, and so I think having those two parts of the government assure employers and provide some guidance about how to deal with individuals coming forward, both in terms of providing evidence for individuals who are going to request deferred action, as well as for once people are approved and come forward, for them not to be adversely affected.
And what about this question that things could change with the election, and how does that affect somebody's decision? What would be your advice?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is this is ultimately, at the end of the day, an individual decision. It is our responsibility as advocates to ensure that individuals have the best information possible. They have legal representation or at least legal guidance if they decide to file a request for deferred action. And, you know, we don't know what's going to happen at the end of, you know, this year with respect to presidential elections. I mean, I would argue that anybody who applies soon and gets granted deferred action is going to be in a better place under a new administration if it were to be Mitt Romney. On the other hand, I think if the Republican Party really understood the importance of this this population in particular for the future of our country, that Mitt Romney should confirm that this isn't a change in policy that he would make. He hasn't publicly addressed that issue.
Can I mention something in regard to that? That's a very real question, and particularly given the timing here, pushed up close to a very closely contested presidential election. But I am guardedly optimistic that these kinds of changes, including the broader changes in the view of how to use prosecutorial discretion sensibly, are finding some resonance. They are sound. They make a lot of sense for a lot of reasons. I think it will be very hard for a new administration to come in and completely clean the decks of that. I think it'll be very hard for them to make a radical change. They may not extend the program after 2 years. It may not go forward, but I would be very surprised to see some use made of this as kind of almost a trap. Okay, now we have information. This is going to be a high priority group we're going after. So it is an individual decision. There is a real reason to have a question mark there, but I do think that for all the controversy over this, there are some solid behavior patterns that are being established that I think will have more staying power as a political matter, not necessarily as a legal matter.
Anybody else wants to weigh on that, in on that, they may. Next question.
Hi, Peggy Lin of the World Journal. Thank you for this program. Also the question is on the deferred action, that if people are granted deferred action and even what next administration would reverse it, and it won't affect them. Is that the case? And also, is the application open-ended? There's no timeline. Like, if people want to wait until after the election, can they still apply after the election so that they can be sure that things would go smoothly?
Well, I think we've answered the question about the first one, but as far as the application period, yes, it's an open app. There is no deadline on this program. It's an open application period, and it will continue into the next year. Next question.
Hi, Antonia Tacades with La Opinión newspaper. Mr. Mayorkas, first, with what Maria Elena was mentioning, there is a concern. I know that traffic violations are not supposed to be considered, and also civil disobedience are not supposed, is not supposed to be considered. But what if a young applicant have a lot of civil disobedience and a lot of traffic violations? Would that be something significant for their application, considering that the agency is saying that they will consider the whole context? And second, Doris, you have a very long career in immigration. You have seen a lot in all of these years. So I was wondering, what's your take on this program? Do you think it will be successful? Do you have any concerns?
Well, Antonieta, if I may answer the first question. Please remember that the decision whether or not to defer action in response to a request under this process is an individualized decision. It's made on a case-by-case basis, taking into account the totality of the circumstances. We anticipate publishing additional guidance with respect to the offense conduct that would disqualify an individual from receiving a favorable exercise of prosecutorial discretion. It's a very case, your question calls for a very case-specific analysis. While minor traffic offenses are not in and of themselves to be considered misdemeanors, taking a look at the record of an individual, we will have to make a decision whether taking a look at the record in its totality, whether this individual really is a threat or danger to public safety. So I don't want to deal in the hypothetical because it is such a fact-based inquiry.
You asked my opinion. My opinion is that this program has all the ingredients of being very successful. I think that it is eminently doable. I think that the fact that it is open-ended in terms of the time period is very positive. And I think that this additional criterion that nobody expected, which came on Friday, that people could be eligible for the program by enrolling in school, is a very positive development. It really signals, I think, a forward-leaning effort and an opportunity for people to, in this age group, who could be eligible to the for the program, to actually take steps that enable them to be eligible. So I would then agree with my colleague Moos that the issue at this point is the issue of feedback into the community that, in fact, it's working, that what the government says is indeed what it means. And that's, of course, why we're having this program and why it is that people are working so hard to try to put it together in a way that makes it possible for that to be demonstrated. Question at the mic.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayorkas, for doing this, to MPI and all the members of the panel for such an excellent discussion and opportunity. My name is Enid Gonzalez. I am the manager of the legal program at Casa de Maryland. Coming from a community-based organization, we are struggling with the details at this point. There are a couple of things that I would like to hear Mr. Mayorga's reaction to with regard to the details, and at the same time to urge you. There's so much talk about the confidence level that's going to be a result of what happens in the beginning of this program. And believe me, our doors are being pushed down with people, you know, so anxious to begin. And there are so many questions that it's difficult to answer. Things like, what is a gap? Is a gap 3 months? Is a gap a year? Will one document per year of the 5 years suffice? Will, with regard to the criminal conduct and conviction bars, there are so many databases today, including Montgomery County here in Maryland has a gang database that nobody really understands how they put that together. In terms of the confidence that the public can have with regard to this program, it would be wonderful if you could say, this is the database that's going to be used. Say, if you do an FBI background check, whatever is on that check is what will be looked at. We will not go beyond this particular database. If you can make some kind of statement, because advocates and legal representatives need to know something very concrete with which to advise applicants. The other issue that I haven't heard anything about, and in fact, yesterday I noticed that on your website, when we look at the application for employment authorization, it says that it cannot be used for the childhood arrival program. So it seems like you're going to have a different application for work authorization. We're very anxious to hear what, if any, consideration will be had for the fact that showing economic necessity, which means showing what your assets, your income, and your expenses are, is going to be very difficult for a young person, and especially for an undocumented young person. So what, if any, measures will be taken to facilitate that, given that this is a population almost by nature that is in need, and the fact that really deferred action without work authorization for somebody who's 25 years old and has yet been able to drive, and a lot of local vehicle administrations will not be issuing licenses if they can't come in with work authorization, or at least it's going to take another half year of advocacy to get them to do that. Work authorization is really critical for this population. And showing economic necessity could be, after you've streamlined the whole process with deferred action criteria, that could get really messy and difficult to do on the ground for thousands of kids. So I'd love to hear your reaction to these questions.
So I appreciate the concerns that you articulate. We are very mindful of the fact that the employment authorization application needs to be simple and straightforward. I don't want to comment on the specific form because that we intend to publish on August 15th because it is in the OMB clearance process, so it would be inappropriate for me to comment on that. But let me underscore the fact that we understand and appreciate the need for clarity and simplicity in the forms process. We also understand that within the framework of the guidelines that we published on Friday, August 3rd, and that I articulated again today, that there are going to be more detailed questions and concerns with respect to specifics, and particularly in certain areas of the guidelines. And what we don't intend to approach a static way that we've published the guidelines on August 3rd and now we're focused on implementation, but rather really to be organic and iterative. We will be providing greater specificity either before or on August 15th and thereafter as issues arise and as the community expresses concerns with respect to details, we will be refining our guidelines so that we are in step in terms of achieving the transparency and clarity that are important, not only in terms of instilling confidence, but in terms of delivering the consistency that I think everyone understands is so important.
Thank you very much.
One other item, you asked about the databases. If I understood your remarks correctly, it is federal databases that will be the basis for the background checks, is that correct?
We're going to be using the federal databases we currently typically access,
right,
and that we typically use.
Okay, well, we're Ah, I see one person here. We're at the end of our time now, so I'm going to ask you to make it short, and we'll try to do a short answer.
I'm Reggie Barker from the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. I had a quick question about confidentiality. In the regulations that were released, there are a few exceptions to the confidentiality, one being some, you know, things that would normally trigger an NTA, and also a knowing misrepresentation. In regards to the knowing misrepresentation, given that there's no appeal process to this, and we're talking about young Americans here, young potential Americans who want to be, what goes into, do they get automatically referred to ICE if you find that there's knowing misrepresentation? Do they get an interview when there's been a determination of knowing misrepresentation? How does that process work?
Let me say this, that the threshold is, as you correctly echoed it, it is one of a potential misrepresentation. We're not talking about a mistake, an inadvertent error, in a clerical error, if you will, but rather an attempted fraud on our agency that it, really impacts the integrity of the system as a whole. We have very experienced individuals in our Fraud Detection National Security Directorate that address these issues. Our adjudicators who will be handling these cases are trained on that. We do envision a level of supervisorial review, and we will be using interviews as a mechanism, not necessarily in every single case, but as a mechanism to really ferret out the facts and make a decision that is really one with integrity.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, audience. Thank you, everybody, for joining us here today. I would urge you to be paying attention to future events, and that we have a big conference coming up on the 1st of October, our annual law and policy conference that we do at Georgetown University Law Center in collaboration with Clinic and with Georgetown. And I would also invite you all to come forward and ask additional questions if you have them. But in particular, thank you very, very much for joining us here today. Thank you, commenters, and all the best wishes. This is a very, very important initiative, and we'll all try to work together to make it succeed. Thank you very much.
For more information on MPI's U.S. Immigration Policy Program and to download the new MPI fact sheet, Relief from Deportation, Demographic Profile of the Dreamers Potentially Eligible Under the Deferred Action Policy, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/research/usimmigration.php.